don't know if I'm going to introduce myself, which is fine with me, but I don't want to step on anybody's toes if somebody was assigned to do that. Is this working? Can you hear me? Okay. Introduction. I'm Ashby Camp. Thanks for coming. But I'm looking around. I'm thinking it looks like I scared some people off last time, but that's how that works. Now, I explained in my chapel talk yesterday that a major theme of the new atheists is that Christianity, like all religions, gets people to believe fantasies. Things they have absolutely no reason to believe are true. And what I'm doing in my classes, I'm refuting that specific charge, that there's no rational basis for believing God exists. No evidence at all from which a person could reasonably conclude God exists. Now, a brother right before the class began asked me if I'd say just a word about new atheism and what makes new atheism. And basically the distinction is, as I said in chapel, it's not their intellectual arguments, their intellectual sophistication, it is their open hostility and lack of tolerance toward religion. They have arisen after 9/11, and you had a number of people, four notable atheists wrote books in the first 6 years after that attacking people's belief in God, and basically what they're saying is, listen, religion is something that is dangerous and horrible, and it deserves to be ridiculed and eliminated. You've had atheists for a long time, but they were more inclined to argue intellectually against the truth of religious claims. These people aren't doing that. These people are in full takedown mode. Okay, so that's who they are. And that's part of the thing when they say, listen, believing Christianity is an embarrassment. There's no intellectual space, and you can't believe the truths, the claims of Christianity. Only if you're a moron can you do that. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get people, as Harris said, it's going to just be too embarrassing for people to believe in God. So I'm addressing that. Okay, I want you to take courage, because that's all nonsense. Nonsense. Now, what I did in the class yesterday, so what I'm doing, I'm refuting that specific charge about there's no rational basis for believing God exists. And as always, I'm concerned. Whenever I do something, I prepare an awful lot of stuff. And what I would like is to be able to get through it. So if you have questions, if you have comments, just let me get through what I'm doing. I may, and I would say probably will, take all the time. And then we can talk afterwards. We can email. That's all good. But let me get through what I would like to say. I would appreciate that. And I do want to encourage you to visit that website. It's theoutlet.us, and you can read there. I have a lengthy paper, I think, the notes, all of this. You can get all the sites. You can get the where they're from and much more. I normally spend 12 weeks when I'm teaching on this, and so I have three classes. So I had to kind of pick and cobble together what I wanted to say in three classes. But if you'll go there, but you'll get my thinking on the new atheism, but many, many other things, some of which you may like, some you may not. But give it a look. If you think it's worthwhile, I'd be grateful if you'd share that with people. Now, in this idea of showing that this charge, that there's no rational basis for believing God exists, showing that that's not correct, what I did in the class yesterday, I argued that it's more reasonable to believe that the universe was brought into existence by something than to believe it was not. And it's more reasonable to believe that this cause, this something, was a timeless, non-physical, and immensely powerful personal being than to believe it was not. Now, what I'm going to look at or argue for this morning, my contention in this class, is that it's more reasonable to believe there is an objective moral standard than to believe there is not, and it is more reasonable to believe that an objective moral standard cannot exist without God than to believe it can. Now, are moral standards, are they objective or subjective? When you say that it's wrong to slit a baby's throat for fun, Do you mean it's inherently wrong? Wrong no matter who says otherwise? Well, in that case, you think it's objectively wrong. The wrongness inheres in the object. It inheres in the conduct itself. Or by calling that conduct wrong, do you mean it's merely contrary to current human opinion on the matter? Something that's subject to change, like clothing styles? Well, in that case, you mean it's subjectively wrong. The conduct isn't wrong itself, but it's wrong only in the sense that it's presently viewed by people as wrong. Its wrongness is dependent on the beholder's opinion of it. You see, rather than being a property of the act itself. So I want you to have a clear idea. What is the difference of objective morality and subjective morality? And to help focus the distinction, if the Nazis had succeeded in conquering the world after in World War II, if they had prevailed, taken over the whole world, and convinced all kinds of people, convinced the masses that slaughtering Jewish children was the equivalent of exterminating cockroaches, would killing Jewish children still be wrong? That's what I'm getting after. Would killing the Jewish children in that case, would it still be wrong? If it became accepted that a father had absolute authority over his family, such that he could sexually abuse his children or could kill them for fun, would his doing so still be wrong? You see, the question is whether right and wrong, whether it's whatever people decide or whether it exists transcendently, whether it exists independently of what people think. Do we make it up or do we discover it? That's the difference between objective and subjective. Now, with many others, I claim it's more reasonable to believe that slitting a baby's throat for fun is objectively wrong than to believe it merely goes against current human opinion, that it merely violates a personal taste or a social convention. It's more reasonable to believe it is objectively wrong because our moral sense. Why do I think it's more reasonable to believe that? I think it's more reasonable to believe that because our moral sense, our moral experience, it tells us that it's objectively wrong, and we have reason to trust that moral sense. Let me flesh that out. Does our moral sense, does our moral experience tell us that? Virtually everyone has a powerful sense that this conduct, slitting a baby's throat for fun, is objectively wrong. I mean, that strikes us as self-evident. It strikes us as something that needs no demonstration. It's obvious, is how we see it. We perceive intuitively and from interacting with other people that there are moral facts, not simply subjective tastes and opinions, and that the wrongness of slitting a baby's throat for fun is an example of that fact is obvious to us. Nothing can make it okay. Nothing can make that okay. One has to suppress that perception. One has to be in denial to claim otherwise. Now, the depth and the power of this sense that morality is objective is illustrated beautifully by Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was probably the most famous atheist philosopher of the 20th century. Not a lightweight. World-renowned atheist philosopher. And Bertrand Russell, he said, "I cannot see how to refute the arguments for the subjectivity of ethical values." He's an atheist. And that's my point, is that atheism gives you no way to stand for objective morality. But he says, I can't see how to refute the arguments for the subjectivity of ethical values, but I find myself incapable of believing. Now that's pretty deep. He says, I see these arguments, but I find myself incapable of believing that all that is wrong with wanton cruelty is that I don't like it. Do you see how deep this is? How deep this is in people? He knew in his heart that there was more to the wrongness of wanton cruelty than his personal opinion. He knew there was more to it than that, but his atheism gave him no way to justify objective morality. And it's our sense that morality is objective that explains the disgust, the anger, the indignation we feel over something like child molestation. You see, if I can't stand the taste of sushi, and somebody else just loves it, I don't get outraged or indignant toward them, you see, because it's a subjective matter. It's a matter of taste. It's completely different if they rape a child. One has the inescapable conviction that a child rapist hasn't simply disagreed with one's personal preference, but has violated a transcendent objective norm. He did wrong, capital W, regardless of who may disagree. And it's our sense that morality is objective that allows us to judge some human laws and accepted cultural practices as unjust or immoral. As Martin Luther King Jr. said in his letter from a Birmingham jail, a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. So people get together and they decide this. Well, the question is, does it square with that? That sits in judgment of the man-made or man-made code or law. He says a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. Likewise, an unjust cultural practice, that's one that's out of harmony with moral law. An unjust cultural practice, if a culture approves abandoning unwanted children to die, as did the ancient Roman society. If a culture comes to think, well, that's fine, just let the unwanted children die. Well, that's not the last word on the practice, right? We don't take that culture's approval as the final word on whether it's moral. We appeal to a transcendent standard, something that is beyond human opinion and culture to judge whether the practice is moral. And so you see all these things. We have this deep intuitive sense. You see it in our sense of how we have anger and indignation. That's telling us there is something more to this than personal taste. You see it in our use of the law to judge, of a moral standard to judge laws that are passed, cultural practices. So what I'm saying to you, there is this objective standard. It's more reasonable to believe that the moral standard is objective than to think it's not. Now you say, okay, I get that there is this ubiquitous sense that slitting a baby's throat for fun is objectively wrong. But is there any reason to believe that that sense is accurate? Okay, I understand that we feel that way. Yes. There's a deep sense, all that. I get that. But is there any reason for us to believe that that deep inner perception is accurate? And there is. It's reasonable to believe that perception is accurate because in the absence of sufficient evidence to the contrary, it's reasonable to believe that our perceptions of reality are trustworthy. In other words, it's reasonable to assume that our grasp of reality is accurate until we have adequate reason to think otherwise. The rational default position is that our perception corresponds to reality. That's the rational default position. For example, I'm justified. It's rational. It's reasonable for me. I'm justified in accepting that the world I perceive to exist through my senses. It's reasonable and rational for me to believe and conclude that that world really exists until I'm given sufficient evidence to the contrary. Perhaps evidence showing that I'm a brain in a vat that's being caused to hallucinate the perception of the world around me. Well, in that case, then it would be justified to say no. But in the absence of evidence like that, I am justified in thinking that my perception of the world around me, that the world does exist. And I'm justified in accepting that the minds I perceive to exist in other people, that those minds do in fact exist. That they're not just robots or automatons acting in a way, but know that what I'm perceiving to be another mind in that body that's acting that way, that it's reasonable for me to conclude that that is true until I'm given sufficient evidence for doubting that or for rejecting that. So there is a basis for this. See, without contrary evidence, it's reasonable for me to assume that my apprehension of reality is true. So I have this strong sense, this moral sense, that morality is objective, and I have a reasonable basis for believing that that sense is accurate. In the same way, it's reasonable for me to assume that that overwhelming perception that morality is objective, it's true, unless I'm given sufficient reason for doubting that. But as Louise Anthony, a professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, as she acknowledged in her debate with William Lane Craig, she says, any argument for moral skepticism, for this idea that I can't trust or rely on my sense that morality is objective, any argument for moral skepticism is going to be based upon premises which are less obvious than the reality of moral values and duties themselves. She says, and therefore it can never be rational to accept moral skepticism. And that's what I'm saying to you, is that I have this deep sense, this moral sense and experience that morality is objective, and I have nothing to push me off that. In fact, you can't even imagine what could it be. Anything that you would say would be less obvious than what I sense and experience, that it is in fact objective. So I believe here we have morality is something objective. There is no sufficient evidence for me to deny my moral experience. Now, okay, so this is where I'm now. The fact it's reasonable to believe that it is objectively wrong to slit a baby's throat for fun, well, that causes a problem for the atheist, because the atheist has no reasonable way to account for objective morality. He has no good way to claim that any conduct, however egregious, however outrageous it may be, that it's wrong in a sense independent of human opinion, that it is inherently wrong. Has no way of doing that. I mean, after all, in the atheist's view, all of existence is necessarily the product of blind, purposeless, natural forces. How could such forces generate a moral standard? I mean, just think about it. If blind, purposeless forces, such as wind or dripping water, if they carved marks in sandstone in the shape, do not eat grapes, that wouldn't create a moral obligation not to eat grapes. And anybody who appealed to those marks to condemn people eating grapes would be ridiculed and taught that mankind is not obligated to obey the fortuities of nature. Mindless phenomena like wind and rain cannot create moral obligation. But if the prohibition against slitting a baby's throat for fun is the product of the same mindless forces as the marks, "Do not eat grapes," it could be no more binding. Any contrary sense that you had necessarily would be an illusion. That's a fact that's recognized by many atheist philosophers. They admit this. So when I'm telling you that atheists have no coherent, rational way to defend objective morality, I am in good company with many atheist philosophers. For example, the atheist philosopher Richard Taylor. He taught at Brown, Columbia, University of Rochester. Taylor wrote, "The concept of moral obligation is unintelligible apart from the idea of God. The words remain, but their meaning is gone." Though Richard Dawkins, like many other atheists, he often appeals to moral absolutes. They're great at that. He wrote in Scientific American in 1995, he said, "The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." And he said the following in his interview with Justin Brierley in October of 2008. Brierley said, "But if we had evolved into a society in which rape was considered fine, would that mean that rape's fine?" Dawkins, "I don't want to answer that question. It's enough for me to say that we live in a society where it's not considered fine." Brierley says, "Okay, but ultimately, your belief that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact that we evolved five fingers rather than six." You could say that, yes. You see, this is what's there. The atheist philosopher Michael Ruse, he wrote in an article in March of 2010. He's from Florida State University. He says, "God is dead, so why should I be good? The answer is that there are no grounds whatsoever for being good. There is no celestial headmaster who's going to give you six or 6 billion billion billion, like whacks or punishment, of the best if you're bad. Morality is flim-flam. Now you know that morality is an illusion put in place by your genes to make you a social cooperator. What's to stop you from behaving like an ancient Roman grabbing Sabine women?" Well, nothing in an objective sense. The atheist Joel Marx, who's professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of New Haven, he put it this way in a 2010 article that was published in Philosophy Now. "I've given up morality altogether. This philosopher has long been laboring under an unexamined assumption, namely, that there is such a thing as right and wrong. I now believe there isn't. How I arrived at this conclusion is the subject of a book I've written. The long and short of it is that I became convinced that atheism implies amorality." Now, when you say that as a believer, you're an idiot. You don't know anything. But I'm telling you, this is well known, besides being obvious. But he says here, "The long and short of it is I became convinced that atheism implies amorality. And since I am an atheist, I must therefore embrace amorality. I experienced my shocking epiphany that the religious fundamentalists are correct. Without God, there is no morality. But they're incorrect, I still believe, about there being a God. Hence, I believe there's no morality. Even though words like sinful and evil come naturally to the tongue as a description of, say, child molesting, they do not describe any actual properties of anything. There are no literal sins in the world because there is no literal God, and hence the whole religious superstructure that would include such categories as sin and evil." Just so I now maintain, nothing is literally right or wrong, because there is no morality, capital M, objective, transcendent. There is none. Now, Alex Rosenberg. Alex Rosenberg is the R. Taylor Cole Professor of Philosophy at Duke University. Okay, so I mean, you think, well, this guy's pretty tuned into the academy. He's pretty tuned into what are philosophers about. He's the R. Taylor Cole Professor of Philosophy at Duke. Well, what does he have to say on the subject? Well, he wrote in his book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality. By the way, Brother Ralph Gilmore, 2 years ago, he debated Rosenberg at Ohio State University in an event that was sponsored by the Warren Apologetics Center. But Rosenberg says in his book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, he says, everyone seems to know what life's persistent questions are. This book aims to provide the correct answers to most of the persistent questions. Here's a list of some of the questions and their short answers. Is there a God? No. What's the nature of reality? What physics says it is. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. There is no moral difference between them. Now, Rosenberg, who happily wears the label nihilist, and he argues that all honest atheists should do the same, he spells out in that same book what that means. And he says, nihilism rejects the distinction between acts that are morally permitted, morally forbidden, or morally required. Nihilism tells us not that we can't know which moral judgments are right, but that they're all wrong. More exactly, it claims they're all based on false, groundless presuppositions. Nihilism says that the whole idea of morally permissible is untenable nonsense. As such, it can hardly be accused of holding that everything's morally permissible. That, too, is untenable nonsense. Moreover, nihilism denies that there is really any such thing as intrinsic moral value. Nihilism denies that there is anything at all that is good in itself, or for that matter, bad in itself. Okay, so I want you to see, when I'm telling you these things, I'm telling you this is the implication of this. I'm not the Lone Ranger. Many people recognize this, and these are atheist philosophers, and they are high-level atheist philosophers who are acknowledging this. In his April 2013 debate with Frank Turek, David Silverman, who was at that time, he was president of a group known as American Atheists, he made the following statements in that debate. There's no such thing as objective morality. All morality is relative, and there is no objective moral standard. Okay, so this is what I'm saying to you. This is where you get. He also said that his preferring a culture that cares for babies over one that eats them, and his condemnation of Nazi atrocities was just, quote, an opinion. And he agreed that people, quote, have every right to do, end quote, what in his opinion is wrong. And yet he still insisted on labeling that behavior as immoral. Now, what happened? You got moral relativism and confused thinking is where his atheist philosophy had driven him. The British atheist philosopher John Gray, he wrote in an article in March of 2015, to be sure, evangelical unbelievers adamantly deny that liberalism needs any support from theism. A liberal morality that applies to all human beings can be formulated without any mention of religion, or so we are continually being told. The trouble is that it's hard to make any sense of the idea of a universal morality without invoking an understanding of what it is to be human that has been borrowed from theism. Well, anyone who wants their values secured by something beyond the capricious human world had better join an old-fashioned religion. If you to set aside any view of humankind that's borrowed from monotheism, you have to deal with human beings as you find them, with their perpetually warring values. Now, atheists who attempt to find to find a basis for objective morality. Atheists who try to get out of this and want to say, yes, I want to believe there's an objective morality, how can I hold to that and hold to my atheism? Those who attempt to do that, they are driven to incoherence. And a prime example of that is the philosopher Michael Ruse. Michael Ruse says, on the one hand, the man who says it's morally acceptable to rape little children is just as mistaken as the man who says 2 + 2 = 5. Well, I'm with that. I think that's right. He says, I want to say what Jerry Sandusky is the guy up at Penn State who was molesting kids. He says, I want to say that what Jerry Sandusky was reportedly doing to kids in the showers was morally wrong. And that this was not just an opinion or something based on subjective value judgments. The truth of its wrongness is as well taken as the truth of the heliocentric solar system. Now that's pretty objective. Right? I mean, he's pretty much saying that, right? So that's on the one hand. That's Michael Ruse A. Now Michael Ruse B says, so morality has to come across as something that is more than emotion. It has to appear to be objective, even though, really, it is subjective. All right? So 2 + 2, it'd be like somebody, oh, but wait a minute, Michael, wait. So you tell me it's like 2, but really that's an illusion. Right? That's an illusion, Michael. Yeah, well, it is. It's an illusion. So it really is subjective. Yeah, it's subjective. Okay, well, why this grandstanding? Why don't you just come out and say it? Because he knows that everybody knows that that's crazy. So he doesn't want to look that way. He wants to talk out of both sides of his mouth. And that's what's happening, and that's what you wind up seeing. He says that. He claims that evolution has fooled us into thinking that certain behavior is object. That evolution, I'm telling you, it's a clever little rascal. Like that rascally rabbit. I mean, this thing is something. But it's fooled us into thinking that morality is, that behavior, certain behavior is objectively wrong. And the atheist philosopher Alex Rosenberg, he concurs with that assessment. He writes in The Atheist Guide to Reality, our core morality isn't true, right, correct, and neither is any other. Nature just seduced us into thinking it's right. It did that because that made core morality work better. Our believing in its truth increases our individual genetic fitness. So they certainly ascribe an awful lot of intention and stuff to this blind, purposeless, random process. But here it's now fooling us into believing that morality is objective. So Ruse and many other atheists, they ask us to deny. They ask us to deny our innate sense that morality is objective on the basis of their dubious assertions that all that exists is matter and physics, and that naturalistic evolution not only has created human minds. When you think about that, it not only has created human minds, but also has commandeered those human minds to generate false perceptions of reality. Now, that's a big pill to swallow. And I don't, you know, somebody sitting here telling me I'm a moron because I'm resisting stuffing that pill down. And it's a mighty big pill to swallow, and it's one they stuff down only because their naturalistic worldview demands that they swallow it. To echo the philosopher Louise Anthony, certainly these claims are less obvious than the reality of moral values and duties themselves. And moreover, if that's the case, now that we've perceived, once we've broken through and we've perceived the evolutionary illusion, now that we've realized the truth, that there are no objective moral standards, but only personal tastes and social conventions, well, why perpetuate the falsehood with double talk? Why do that? Why perpetuate the falsehood? I mean, why not free people from this false perception that our genes have fobbed off on us? Why not liberate them from the guilt that they carry for having committed what they falsely believed were objective wrongs? I mean, after all, if somebody was racked with guilt because of a mistaken belief that stepping on a crack on the sidewalk was immoral, what would we do? We would try to relieve him of that by enlightening him. No, you're making a mistake. There's nothing to worry about with that. Well, that's what these people are saying is true of everything. So why don't we relieve people in a pursuit of truth to say, listen, you have no reason to be guilty. And this is what's actually coming through in the society, and that's why it's going nuts. Because the message is coming through that there is no difference. And it's all based on this atheist, what I judge to be complete nonsense. And of course, one can't stop at thinking that evolution has tricked us into believing that morality is objective. I mean, it's evolution, like I say, it's some really tricky stuff. It created our mind, it commandeered it into giving us a false perception of reality, but why think it only gives us that false perception? Why think of that? If we have to deny our sense of objective morality on the fantastic theory that it's a genetically induced mirage, we've got no less reason to deny that the love that we're certain that we experience with our spouse and with our children, it's also a mirage. I mean, why not? Evolution has simply taken us and made us feel that sense that we have of a relationship of love, you don't really. That's an illusion. It's a mirage by this really clever thing that's running down here. Now, why? You can't stop there. You can't stop at that thing. The new atheist charge notwithstanding, it's perfectly rational and reasonable to hold to the reality of these perceptions rather than think that we are the deluded pawns of a blind and random process that shows absolutely no capacity to achieve such a fantastic effect. So I'm sitting here saying it's perfectly reasonable for me to think that that's a clown answer. That's just a terrible answer. But they're saying because I'm committed to this, it's the only answer, and you got to stuff it. And when I say I'm not stuffing it, they say, well, you're a moron. I said, well, I'm not looking at it that way. So, now I submit to you that Ruse's incoherence, that reflects his inability to believe that all that's wrong with child molestation is that he personally has been programmed by his genes not to like it, to perceive it as wrong. He knows. He knows by intuition and moral experience that there's more to it than that. But his atheism gives him no way to explain how there can be more to it than that. So that's why he talks out of both sides of his mouth, claiming it's not an opinion or a subjective value judgment, and yet insisting it is a subjective judgment that we've been fooled into believing is objective. I mean, it's almost funny to me. Almost funny to me watching atheists express moral indignation and outrage over certain conduct, especially when they think they can blame it on religion. They really go to town at that point. In his May 2007 debate with Christopher Hitchens in Christianity Today, the Christian theist Douglas Wilson, he kept pressing Hitchens throughout the debate. He kept pressing him to provide a rational basis for labeling any conduct good or bad. I mean, if existence consists solely of matter acting according to various laws of nature, it's meaningless to speak of any conduct as either good or bad. It simply is. It simply is. I mean, we might as well say it's good for a flower to be yellow, bad for a flower to be red. You see, all such declarations, they necessarily, in that worldview, they necessarily are arbitrary and meaningless. And the best that Hitchens could muster to answer Wilson's persistent inquiry was to say, our morality evolved. Now, as I've indicated, that's a standard tack taken by atheists who want to keep their atheism, but who also want to feel justified in their moral condemnation of other people. So they want to be able to blast people and then also hold on to atheism. What I'm telling you, that's incoherent. They can't rationally and logically do that. Well, I think Wilson did a beautiful job of exposing the fatal defect in this claim. Wilson said, that's Michael Ruse, you already saw that. Wilson said, on the question of morality, you again attempt an answer. My answer is the same as it was all along. He's quoting Hitchens here. Our morality evolved. And then Wilson says, there are two points to be made about this reply. The first concerns evolved morality and the future, and is a variation on my previous questions. If our morality evolved, then that means our morality changes. If evolution isn't done yet, and why should it be, then that means our morality is involved in this ongoing flux as well. And that means that everything we consider to be moral is really up for grabs. Our vague yet grand conception of human rights, because he championed himself as a big proponent of human rights, right? He says our vague yet grand conception of human rights might flat disappear just like our gills did. Our current, quote, morals are therefore just a way station on the road. No sense getting really attached to them, right? I mean, why get worked up if somebody's violating it? He says, when I'm traveling, I don't get attached to motel rooms. I don't weep when I have to part from them. So in the future, after every ferocious moral denunciation you choose to offer your reading public, you really need to add something like, but this is just a provisional judgment. Our perspective may evolve to an entirely different one some years hence. Or, provisional opinion only, morality changes over time. Pumcot, for short. He said it would look like this. The Reverend Snoutworthy is an odious little toad, not to mention a waste of skin, and his proposal that we prosecute the brassiere editors of the Sears catalog on pornography and racketeering charges is an outrage against civilized humanity. But, Pumcot, this relates to the second point, which concerns evolved morality and the past. When dealing with people whose moral judgments have differed from yours, do you regard them as immoral or as less evolved? The rhetoric of your book, your tone in these exchanges, and your recent dancing on the grave of the late Jerry Falwell would all seem to indicate the former. In your choice of words, the people you denounce are to be blamed. The word fulminations comes to mind. You write like a witty but acerbic 10th century archbishop with a bad case of the gout. But this is truly an odd thing to do if morality is simply a derivative of evolution. Are you filled with fierce indignation that the koala bear hasn't evolved ears that stick flat to the side of his head like they're supposed to? Are you wroth over the fact that clams don't have legs yet? When you notice that the bears at the zoo continue to suck on their paws, do you stop to remonstrate with them? And I think you get the idea. Now, because atheism is incompatible with the existence of objective morality, our moral sense, it bears witness to the falsity of atheism. It's telling us at a profound experiential level that atheism is not true. I mean, in the atheist's insistence that one is to reject in their insistence that one is to reject that clear moral sense that we have, that we're to reject it as an illusion, in that, I hear the old line, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Now, the question isn't whether atheists can be good people. When you talk like this, you're saying, no, that's not the question at all. Whether atheists can be good people, whether they can know moral standards and seek to live by them. Certainly they can. Certainly they can. I mean, after all, they've been made in God's image. And they've been given a certain moral awareness or sensitivity as a result of that. This is the law of the heart. In Romans chapter 2, 14 and 15, the question's whether they can have a rational basis. Whether they can have a rational basis for affirming that morality is objective, transcendent. And they can't. They're left to view the enforcement of any behavioral standard. They are left to view the enforcement of any behavioral standard as the imposition of one person's or group's personal preference against another. You see, in that case, in that scheme, there are no wrongdoers in the true sense. There are simply people who have different opinions, and if I happen to control the political power, well, then that's tough for you. You see, there are no wrongdoers. It's everything then is a matter of political power. Everybody in jail, they're not wrongdoers, they're political prisoners. And you see this also reflected in the culture. But that's what's going on. And you see that that's happening. Now, atheists, including some of the new breed, they sometimes, well, I just got a couple minutes, see if I can get through this. They sometimes, they try to undermine the claim that God helps in explaining the existence of objective morality. So I'm saying, listen, they have nothing. They have no way to explain this. They say, well, the existence, let's say I concede the existence of objective morality, well, that doesn't really help you get to God because you can't really ground that in God. Okay, I think they're wrong. But you will hear this come up, and when they do this, they raise what's known as the Euthyphro dilemma. You've probably heard of that. Sam Harris raised that in his argument in April of 2011 in his debate with William Lane Craig. Jerry Coyne raised it in an online article in August of 2011. And that name, the Euthyphro dilemma, it comes from a question that was asked by Socrates in Plato's early 4th century BC work titled Euthyphro. And the essence of that question is, do the gods will something because it's good, or is something good because the gods will it? Now, Euthyphro was a polytheist. And their gods, they were merely somewhat more powerful, somewhat more knowledgeable than humans, but they were still flawed. But when you take that question, you put it into the context of Judeo-Christian monotheism, the question is something good because God commands it? Or does God command something because it's good? Now, that's seen as a dilemma. It's seen as a dilemma because if God commands something because it's good, well, then the good is independent of him. It's something that exists outside and above him. So he's not necessary for its explanation. If, on the other hand, God's act of commanding is what makes it good, then he could make anything good by commanding it. And that makes good and evil arbitrary. Right? Something is neither good nor evil unless he makes it so by commanding it or prohibiting it. So commanding one thing would be no different from commanding another. Now, the classic response when that's raised or pressed upon Christians or others who believe in the God of Scripture is that it's a false dilemma. That there is a third alternative. It's not the case that God wills something because it's good as determined by a standard that's outside or above him, nor is it the case that something becomes good only when he commands it. Rather, God himself is good. God himself is good by nature, and that goodness necessarily is reflected in what he commands and prohibits. What he wills can never conflict with who he is. His will is neither grounded in anything external to himself, nor is it arbitrary. So that's the classic response to the Euthyphro dilemma. But some atheists, they object to this response. I'm almost finished. Some atheists object to this response to the Euthyphro dilemma. They say, look, saying that God's nature, they say it, God's nature cannot be known. You're saying that God is good intrinsically and that everything is rooted in him, but you can't know that God is good unless there's a standard to which he can be compared to establish that he's good. Right? Or otherwise, it's meaningless. In other words, they assert that to say God is good is necessarily to refer to a standard that is outside or beyond good, which means that he's not the source or the grounding of the standard, in which case that response doesn't really get around the Euthyphro problem. So you have people that say that. They say, look, by saying that God is good, you are appealing implicitly to a standard of goodness outside of God. And to this I say, not so fast. Okay? If one accepts that there is indeed an objective moral standard as we recognize innately, as we recognize intuitively, that standard must originate. It must be grounded somewhere. Otherwise, there would be an infinite regress of standards to justify the prior standard. In other words, if a standard is needed to judge whether God's nature is good, well, we can't know his nature is good. We've got to have a standard to judge. Okay, then how do we know that standard's good? We've got to have a standard to judge whether that's, and that one, another one, and that one, another one. So what you wind up with then is an infinite regress. You see, you need standards to get there, which means that objective morality could never originate. You see, it could never originate, and therefore it couldn't exist. So if objective morality exists, if it is objectively wrong to slit a baby's throat for fun, it necessarily is grounded somewhere, but the atheist's only option is to insist it derives from matter. That's their only option, and I contend there's no reasonable basis for claiming that inanimate matter can generate moral obligations. So the atheist is left without a reasonable explanation for the grounding of objective morality, whereas the theist is not. God's nature is the foundation of the good. Now, of course, the consistent atheist, he'll say, look, there's no, like the fellow at Duke, Rosenberg, all of those people I read to you, they would wind up saying, look, there is no objective morality. There is none. It's an illusion, so there's nothing that needs to be grounded. Okay, I would understand that. That's coherent, but that's the point. That's the point. You see, to hold to their atheism, they have to deny, to coherently, reasonably hold to atheism, they have to deny that objective morality exists, which is less reasonable than accepting the existence of objective morality. And not only is it more reasonable to believe an objective moral standard exists, it's more reasonable to believe that God is the source and the grounding than to think we're obligated to obey the fortuities of nature. Okay, so I wanted to go through that because when you talk the way I'm talking, you'll hear the Euthyphro problem. And so I wanted to at least arm you for that. Now, being made in God's image, we have an innate moral sense. We are to some extent tuned to what is moral and right. But of course, being fallen creatures, our sense in that regard is fallible. I mean, it's been damaged. Our conscience can be seared, so we have to inform our conscience by studying God's revelation. Here's my conclusion. I know you're glad. It's more reasonable to believe there is an objective moral standard than to believe there is not. And it is more reasonable to believe that an objective moral standard cannot exist without God than to believe it can. Thanks for hanging in.